waiting for. Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order for the legislative session for 2017. This is our first meeting, and so I'll open an organizational meeting first. And maybe we'll start out with just an introduction of the committee members and staff. So let's start to my left.
I'm Representative Julie Fahey from House District 14, West Eugene and Junction City.
Dallas Hurd, House District 2, Roseburg down to Grants Pass area.
Hey, Margaret Doherty, House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland.
Greg Barreto, House District 58, which is Union County, part of Umatilla County, and Wallowa County.
Representative Paul Holvey from House District 8, which is South Eugene, Vinita, Lorraine, Notai, Walton, Cheshire.
Good afternoon. I'm Janelle Bynum, House District 51, East Portland, Damascus, Gresham, Boring, North Clackamas, and Happy Valley.
Bill Kenimer, representative from South Clackamas County.
Paul Evans, representing House District 20, Monmouth Independence, West Salem, South Salem, the prettiest district in the state of Oregon.
We're going to have to file a motion.
Glad to be with you, Chair. Glad to be back in the committee.
Pretty hard to argue.
Jody Hack, and I, too, have parts of South Salem, Almsville, and Turner, and my district is the prettiest in the state, and I get to speak last, so there you have it.
Yeah, okay.
Not quite.
I don't want to fight about that.
Actually, how about if I share in that Oregon is the prettiest state there is, and we all have the best district.
There we go. So we have a new committee assistant. If you'd introduce yourself, please. Somebody's ducking.
Because I'm an old.
Welcome.
And I'm Jan Nordland, the committee analyst. And even though I sit next to the chair, I want to remind you that I serve all of the members of the committee. So please reach out to me anytime you have a question about committee process or specifics about the bill. Please give me a call.
So thank you. Representative Barreto, could you make a motion for me, please?
Chair Holvey, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 1st, 2017.
Representative Barreto has moved the adoption of the committee rules for the House Committee on Business and Labor for the 2017 session, rules as presented. Any discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. With that, I will close the organizational meeting and open a public hearing on House Bill 2161. Jan, if you could give us a brief description of the bill, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is a measure that allows amendments to the credit union bylaws and the Articles of Incorporation to become effective automatically 30 days after submission to the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. But the director would be able to disapprove or require additional information. Allows credit union to expel members who create an undue risk, and allows the DCBS director to set minimum frequency of meetings of the credit union's board of directors, and allows the credit union to exercise powers that are available to federal credit unions as of January 1, 2017. There's a dash one amendment that was just posted on OLS just recently, and I'll call your attention to it. It would require the amendments to the Articles of Incorporation to be approved in writing by the DCBS director before becoming effective.
Thank you. And we have three people signed up in favor of the bill, so we'll start with them. If you'd introduce yourself before your testimony, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I'm Pam Levitt, and I represent the Northwest Credit Union Association. We have 65 state and federally chartered credit unions in Oregon with 2 million Oregonians as members. Today, you're going to hear some background on our bill, House Bill 2161, which updates the Oregon Credit Union Act. This is a process that we work and go through every 2 years to go through and look at our act to see what kinds of updates and changes need to be made, and our panel will address this. Yes. It's good to see all of you. It's kind of feels like the first day of school today, and thank you for having our bill up first. Before I turn it over to the panel, I just wanted to let you know that we, the three of us, submitted written testimony, and I'm not going to read my testimony, but I gave you some really good background on credit unions. As you know, we're not-for-profit financial cooperatives. Organized to meet the needs of our members, democratically controlled. 41.7 Oregonians, 41% of Oregonians are members of their local credit unions, and you'll find our members in credit unions in every walk of life. We work and strive to have a legislative climate that recognizes our unique structure and mission. We will look forward to presenting to you the release of our 2017 Economic Impact Report, which we do every 2 years on the economic impact of Oregon credit unions in our state. Finally, I just wanted to say that in our discussions with our regulator, DCBS, they did request a clarifying amendment, which we fully support, to make sure that in our changes to the bylaw approval process, we are not addressing the Articles of Incorporation. So we do support that amendment, and we consider it a clarifying amendment. So thank you, and I will turn it over to our panel, if that's okay.
All right. Well, good morning or good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Scott Burgess, and I'm the president and CEO of Rivermark Community Credit Union. And just a little bit about our credit union. We currently serve approximately 85,000 members across the state of Oregon. We serve 11 counties, members ranging from the Salem area up to the Portland metropolitan area and over as far east as the Dalles and Maupin. And we were founded in 1951 as Safeway Credit Union. And in 2004, we converted to a community charter and changed our name to Rivermark Community Credit Union. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today in support of House Bill 2161. Credit unions every day across the state are doing some extraordinary things in our community, and I just want to just touch on briefly something that's going on at Rivermark that I'm extremely proud of. We set up an endowment called the Rivermark Fund in partnership with the Oregon Community Foundation, and with this endowment, we support nonprofits that support economic development, small business development across the state of Oregon. We're very proud of that fund. We made our first donation in the fall of 2016 to the Oregon Thai Young Entrepreneurs Program, and we look forward to growing that fund well into the future. Just want to touch very briefly on the process by which credit unions have gotten together and talked about the issues that confront them in order to best serve our members and why this bill is before you. Prior to the legislature convening every 2 years, credit union CEOs from state chartered credit unions from across Oregon come together and we talk about what is it that we need to best serve our members. We recognize that the financial services environment is changing constantly, the consumer needs are changing constantly, and as member-focused, not-for-profit financial cooperatives, it's very important that state law keep up with the needs of our members. So we get together every 2 years, talk about what is it that we need. We look at Oregon statute, make some determinations based on what the law says and what we need changed, and that's ultimately how we come up with recommendations that made it into this bill. And I would just, one other comment that I would make, that as a state chartered credit union, we've been one for many, many years, we really appreciate the opportunity to be able to come to the state legislature every 2 years, have a conversation about what it is that we need to best serve our members, and the responsiveness of the state charter is really something that is very special, especially compared to a federal charter. So that really is quick on the process, but just wanted to let you know a little bit of the context behind that.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley Wada Witt in Portland, and we represent the Northwest Credit Union Association and many of the credit unions that are serving your constituents in the state of Oregon. I would like to take this opportunity to say for the record that I believe that all of your districts are quite picturesque. So This bill is actually very brief and straightforward, and yet, as Pam said, we do manage to have an amendment to it. But the amendment is equally brief and straightforward. The bill really does four simple changes. The first is the current process in the statute for changing bylaws, which are really an internal document that primarily deals with the governance of the credit union, the board, the supervisory committee, membership rights, meetings, and things like that. Currently, bylaw changes have to be submitted to the DCBS for approval, and then the DCBS, if they approve, actually has to write an approval, and the bylaw change doesn't take effect until that formal written approval is granted by the DCBS. And this will simply take away the need for the formal written approval. If DCBS approves, they don't have to do anything, and the amendments will automatically take effect after 30 days once they've been submitted. If DCBS looks at it and they say they have a question, they need more information, they can do that, and the clock doesn't start ticking until they get the information they need, or if they want to disapprove, they still have that right. This just, again, streamlines the process so that they don't have to go through the actual act of creating the written formal approval. That's the first change. The second change, oh, and I would say that's what the amendment also will deal with. The same section in the statute addresses both bylaw changes and changes in the articles of incorporation, which almost nobody ever changes unless they're changing their name. And we have no problem with requiring formal written approval for changes to the articles of incorporation, and that's what the amendment will clarify. Second thing that the bill does is deals with expulsion of members, and there's currently a list of reasons why credit unions can expel members from their membership. And when we're dealing with members who create a potential risk to the credit union, and you look at that list, it mostly deals with risks that have already occurred. Somebody has already caused harm to the credit union, they've already cost money to the credit union, or something like that. And this is to make it a little clearer that the credit union can act proactively when it needs to. If somebody is engaged in activity that appears to be fraudulent or kiting, or they're doing something else they're through their account that's illegal or unlawful, otherwise creates a risk of loss to the credit union, the credit union doesn't need to wait until the loss actually occurs in order to expel them from membership. So this is to protect the interest of all the members and the funds of the credit union as a whole. Third change is the frequency of board meetings, which is set currently in the statute at 10 per year plus one. And this is to say that the DCBS can set by rulemaking the number of required meetings every year for the board of directors. And the reason for that, again, is to give a little more flexibility to the DCBS to decide what's appropriate and in what circumstances, and of course to make exceptions as well. This matches exactly the same standard that's set forth in the Bank Act for banks. And last but not least is an update to what we call the strike date, or the effective date for what's called the federal parity provision. This provision, as Scott mentioned, it addresses equality of competition and powers between state chartered credit unions and federal credit unions. The whole point of it is to make sure that the Oregon state charter is an attractive alternative to a federal charter for credit unions in the state of Oregon. And we have to have an effective date in that statute in order to avoid an unconstitutional legislative delegation of powers issue. And we update that date periodically in order to keep it fresh, essentially, so that we're looking at powers that are currently available, or at least very recently available, to a credit union, a federal credit union, instead of powers that were available, you know, 5, 8, 10 years ago. And a part of that reason is that in addition to being able to exercise a power of a federal credit union, the state chartered credit union would have to be subject to all the same rules and restrictions that apply to that federal credit union. Well, those regulations change over time, and even if the power is the same, for instance, a power related to investing in real property to own a branch, if you're looking at the restrictions that are in effect now on a federal credit union, those might be different than the restrictions that were in effect 5 years ago. And so you say, well, we have this power to do this because a federal credit union does, but we have to remember to go back and look at what the regulation looked like 5 years ago so that we're sure we're abiding by the right set of restrictions. That's one reason we keep it fresh and up to date. That's all the bill does, and I appreciate your time this afternoon. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Doherty.
Thank you very much for your testimony. On the new language about risk, well, I mean, what sort of risks are those of people going bankrupt, or what sort of risks are we talking about?
Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty, thanks for the question. It really could pose, it could represent a whole variety of risks from somebody who may have appeared to open an account fraudulently, but they haven't necessarily actually successfully taken any money from the credit union yet. That's a more and more common scenario with identity theft now, where credit unions have the ability to identify through a variety of procedures, enhanced, you know, computer software detection type of procedures. This person appears to be a fraudulent account, but they haven't stolen anything from us yet, because one of the things that they do sometimes is, you know, they open an account, they let it sit for a month, and then they start the fraudulent activity. But if we can identify that now and get them out now, then we eliminate that risk before it actually occurs. That would be one example. Another would be if somebody opens a business account and we discover that the business is doing something illicit, it might not expose the credit union to a direct risk of monetary loss, but it could expose the credit union to potentially regulatory scrutiny or penalties because of enhanced requirements to deal with that business or that business account. And it may, in fact, pose a monetary risk as well. Those are a couple of examples.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Other questions? So the chair's question. So I appreciate this. It appears that the approval of the amendments to the Articles of Incorporation are a streamlining effort that will provide certainty to the credit unions and also an easier pathway for DCBS as well. So I'm assuming that that change wasn't brought forward because of the long length of time that DCBS may have been taking to approve these amendments in the past.
Chair Holvey, it's a variety of factors, and I think one of the factors is simply a desire to work cooperatively with the DCBS, and if we can avoid them having to take extra steps to make something like that happen, it's easier for them as well as for us, and they can focus on other more important things as opposed to, you know, going through that formal process. Because even though it might just be actually putting together a document, and, you know, when you're dealing with an agency like that, there is more of a formal process involved in that. And so, again, it's really it's part of the cooperative effort between the credit unions and the DCBS.
Chair Holvey, we have a very strong working relationship with our regulator, and we work very openly and communicate. We did this actually 2 years ago on branch application fees. One of our updates to the Oregon Credit Union Act when we were before you 2 years ago was the same kind of process on branch applications. So we're always looking at a streamlined approach to working with the regulator and business practices. So, but to answer your question, we have a very good, strong relationship with them.
Well, thank you. It appears that it would actually save DCBS some resources, this process. Thank you very much. I don't see any other questions. Thank you for your testimony today. I thought I might ask DCBS to come up for just a minute, if they don't mind. I know you're not. I'm not going to ask any difficult question.
Bring my laptop.
Thank you. And my question is, you don't foresee this causing any problem with DCBS being able to adequately review and approve the amendments to their articles of incorporation?
No, to answer your question, Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Teresa Van Winkle, Senior Policy Advisor for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. No, I mean, actually, first and foremost, we'd like to thank the Northwest Credit Union Association to talk for speaking with us in advance and making sure that we had full knowledge of the bill and any concerns we had prior to the opening day today. So we appreciate that. So my understanding, and I actually brought Alex Chang, who is a policy analyst for the Division of Financial Regulation, which is the division that regulates state chartered credit unions. My understanding is that, no, I think with the bill, there is really no problem with us in doing implementation.
Yeah, that's correct.
And since you answered, could you state your name for the record, please?
Sure. My name is Alex Chang. I'm a senior policy analyst for DCBS.
All right. That was my only concern, so thank you very much. Wire, is there any other questions of these before folks before they leave? No. Thanks a lot. Have a great day. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2161 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2262, 2263, and 2264. And Jan, would you review those three bills for us, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members. 2262 allows the Employment Relations Board to employ management service and unclassified employees. It changes the title of their executive secretary to an executive manager and makes it an unclassified position. Changes the status of the head of the State Conciliation Service to an unclassified position. And it removes a requirement that the board, acting at the direction of their executive staff, estimate future expenses and costs for purposes of state agency assessments. It allows only a labor organization to petition to add unrepresented employees to an existing unit. It requires a petition for representation without election to be signed by a majority of the employees, and allows employees of the mass transit districts, transportation districts, and municipal bus systems to the statutes affecting other strike-prohibited employees. 2263 is a measure that increases the maximum fee to $625 for the third mediation session, and it lowers the maximum fee to $625 for the fourth mediation session. It allows the board to establish fees for providing labor relations and negotiation training. And then finally, House Bill 2264, it increases the application fee to be included on the State Conciliation Service list of qualified arbitrators. Fee would go from $50 to $100, and the annual fee to remain on that list would increase from $100 to $150.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And we have Adam Reinhard. So you have three bills to talk about and start at the top, but maybe before you do that, many times in this committee I do informational meetings, so especially new members can get familiar with what is the Employment Relations Board. So maybe in a few minutes you can tell us a little bit about the Employment Relations Board and what its function is.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Holby. My name is Adam Reinhard. I'm the chair of the Employment Relations Board. And the board is essentially the dispute resolution agency for all Oregon public sector employees, employers, and labor organizations. We also have some jurisdiction over some private sector employers. We have three statutes that we administer. One is the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, which, again, really deals with public employers, employee representation by labor unions, and public employers. We also have jurisdiction over the State Personnel Relations Act, or law, I should say, and that basically is a statute that gives certain appeal rights to certain state employees who are not represented by a labor organization and certain management service employees to appeal certain personnel actions made by the state. And lastly, we have jurisdiction over a small group of private sector employers who do not meet the jurisdictional standards of the National Labor Relations Board. And generally what we do is we process unfair labor practices practice complaints. We process representation matters. If employees want to be represented by a labor organization, they can file those petitions with the agency. If they don't want to be represented by the labor organization, they can file decertification. We also do unit clarification petitions for labor organizations that already represent employees. It might be that there's a change in the construction of the employer or the work group, or there's a question about whether folks are supervisory or not, and we take petitions on those and make determinations and clarify an already existing unit. And that's largely, I think, an overall of what we do. It's about approximately 250,000 public employees and about 3,000 public employers that we oversee.
Great. So maybe if you could start off by providing us some information about these bills now.
Sure. Do you mind if I start with 2264 and work them?
You can do it in any order you would like,
great,
since all three are open.
Okay.
Just clarify which one you're talking about at the time. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chair Holvey. So, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, again, my name is Adam Reinert. I'm the chair of the Employment Relations Board, and I'm testifying on behalf of, in favor of, House Bills 2262, 2263, and 2264. And I'd like to start with 2264 and sort of work backwards, because the last one's the more complicated and nuanced one, and these other ones, I think, are a little more straightforward. So, one of the things that the board does is that it maintains a list of labor arbitrators. So if parties have a dispute about something and it goes to arbitration, we maintain a list of qualified labor arbitrators that parties can ask for that list from us. We currently have about 72 arbitrators that are on that list. That number sort of goes up and down depending year to year, from about 70 to 75. And over the last 2 years, we've processed, I believe, 321 requests for arbitrators for an arbitrating panel. So what happens if someone wants to be on our panel is they would go ahead and submit an application. The board needs to review it, check their qualifications according to our rules to see if they're qualified to be on our panel. And along with that, there is a $50 fee. That fee was set back in 2007. To stay on the list annually, they also need to submit a fee of $100 to remain on that list. Again, that same fee was set back in 2007. So what this bill does is it just ups those application and renewal fees. So it ups it to $100 for the application fee and $150 for the annual fee. Our federal counterpart, the FMCS, which deals with private sector employees and employers mostly, they also have a $150 annual fee. Other groups such as AAA, that number's now up to, I believe, $650 annually to be on their list. So this is sort of a modest increase to sort of reflect sort of the value of the service that we provide. And that's essentially the nature of the bill. I'm happy to take any questions on that.
Any questions on the line? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are the mediators contracted with the state?
Chair Helby, Representative Hack, these are not dealing with mediators. Our mediators are separate from arbitrators. So we do have some mediators on the staff that actually do mediation, which is about trying to get the parties to come to a resolution or an agreement, whereas an arbitrator is actually going to issue a decision.
Are the arbitrators. Are they contractors?
The arbitrators are not contractors of the state, no. So some of them aren't even in the state. So we have arbitrators from all over the United States that are on the list.
But do they contract? Is the work contracted? So these are private entities. They have their own companies who contract, and that's why they have to pay the fee? Is that
correct? They're usually just private individuals, and they can apply to us as an individual. They're not contractors with the state. We have no involvement with the actual arbitration proceeding once it happens. We merely maintain the list for folks, and then if they ask us, can we have a list of 5 arbitrators or 7 arbitrators, we go through that list and then provide them with the list. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. Can I have one more?
Follow up.
So the fee increase, where do these dollars go?
Chair Holvey, Representative Hack, the fee increases, our agency, this is a little bit of a complicated question. Our agency has 3 different funding resources. One is from the general fund. We also have a state assessment. And then we have what are called other revenue fees. And basically, those fees get split really across all agency services, kind of proportionate to our general overall budget, if that makes sense. I'm seeing that it does not make sense. So let's say that, you know, 4%, let's say it's a small amount. It wouldn't be 4%, but let's say 4% of our budget came from these fees. People's paychecks every week, 4% of that would come from that pot of money. And then the other 96 would come from the other two pots of money. So it really gets sort of spread out amongst all of our services and supplies. We sort of split those according to the source.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Doherty?
Well, maybe just a clarification that the arbitrators are independent people, and so you've got management and labor that are going to arbitration, and you send us a list of X amount of arbitrators. We scratch them off. The arbitrator that's left, actually, we pay the arbitrator's fee. It's just ERB is doing the job of getting us a list of arbitrators that have kind of been vetted and have been around for a long time. And I noticed on the list a lot of them are still around. But the state does not pay the fee for the arbitration. The two parties do. So
that's correct. And the fees range. Each arbitrator sets their own fees. Some charge, I think, currently up to from $700 a day to over $1,900 a day, depending on the arbitrator and what they want to charge.
Any other questions on House Bill 2264? Not seeing any. Move to the next bill of your choice.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Members of the committee, I'll move on to House Bill 2263. And this bill really does two things. One of the things that the board does is it provides for mandatory mediation if public employers and their labor organizations cannot come to an agreement after a period of bargaining. And currently, the statute charges $1,000 for the first two mediation sessions, charges $500 for the third, $750 for the fourth, and then $1,000 for any sessions thereafter. This bill is really just meant to simplify the sort of process so there's not so many fees going up and down. The original impetus for this sort of fee distinction was there was a thought that if the there was a big jump between the third and the fourth, that might incentivize parties to settle at the third session. That hasn't really been our experience. Is there any sort of distinction between those two? About 80% of our cases are resolved within the first two mediation sessions, or sort of we'd help two mediation sessions. The other 13% are split about 50-50 in terms of whether they have 3 days or four or more, and some of them have well more than four. So again, this was really just meant to simplify that. It's intended to be revenue neutral. It raises the third mediation session fee by the same amount that it decreases the fourth mediation session fee. And then the other thing is just a slight language change in terms of the type of training that we provide. Currently, the statute talks about interest-based bargaining, which is a very specific term of art, and the agency actually provides training, and not only interest-based bargaining, but lots of labor management training and labor management cooperation. So that language change was just intended to capture that. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions on this bill?
I promise I won't do this all the time.
Representative
Thank you,
Heck.
Mr. Chair. Just a clarification, I guess. It says it allows board to establish fees for providing labor relations and negotiation training. So the board will be the one that establishes what those fees are and who pays those fees.
Chair Helby, Representative Hack. Yes, the fees are the fees that are set forth above. Those are the fees that we pay. And these are fees that are split between local public employers and labor organizations. We do not charge the state these sorts of fees because there's a state assessment. And with that state assessment comes we provide all of our services to the state for free. But these are the mediation sessions that for training, these are split between the parties typically. So if for example, an employer and a union want, they say, hey, we would like you to come and provide us with some training on our labor relations, or we want interest-based bargaining training. Can you come to us and do that? We will do that, and we will then charge them. Usually they split the fee 50-50.
Can I just have a clarification? So if a school district wants training on mediation, then are these the fees that they're going to pay for the training on how to conduct the mediation, or does your board set the fee that you're going to charge a school district?
Chair Helvey, Representative Hack, there are two separate two, and I apologize if I conflated the two, but there are really two separate sorts of fees. There's the mediation fees, which really involve these particular types of mediations, and then separate from that is our training fees, which we do set, and there's a schedule for those, for what those fees are. So they would come to us and they would say, we want the training. We would say, okay, here's the fee. And again, if they were along with a labor organization, they would either split the fee or they would just pay us the fee. Does that answer your question?
Not entirely, because okay. It says allows board to establish fees.
Correct. So we do have fees for our training that we have established.
If I may, these are existing fees.
Correct.
That you already charge for these services, and the school board or union or whatever employer it might be can either choose to pay those fees and have that service or not. It's sort of a menu item they can partake in or not partake in.
Chair Holby, that's exactly correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
I think I was trying to get to your answer.
Yep, you answered it. Thank you.
Any other questions on this one?
Well, just maybe a comment.
Comment, Representative Doherty?
Mediation is actually one of those services put on by the Employment Relations Board that is extremely helpful, because when you have two parties that are kind of at odds with one another, to have a third-party neutral come in and kind of go back and forth and back and forth, it is probably resolved more labor conflicts than anything. So it's a very good service to have. And they're very good.
Well, Representative Doherty, I couldn't agree more. They do God's work.
All right. Any other questions on this one? I guess there's one more bill you want to talk about.
Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee. The last bill is HB 2262, and there's a lot of different pieces and sections to this. There's eight different sections, and it's a little bit involved and nuanced. But what I wanted to say at the outset is that most of these are really, what I would call sort of housekeeping changes, kind of intended to have the statutory language kind of mirror the current organizational structure of the board. You know, this enacting legislation was passed in 69 and then amended in 79 and hasn't been touched since then. And there's been a lot of changes in sort of the state agency and the process and how the board works throughout the years. And the statute just has never sort of reflected that. So this is really meant to sort of kind of capture those sorts of distinctions. So section one of the bill changes the title. It says that we shall have an executive secretary. It just changes it to executive manager to really more adequately reflect the position. It is currently codified and it's part of DAS in the unclassified service. It says it's in the classified service, but it is an unclassified service under ORS 240-205. So it's really meant to capture the nature of that that position. Section 2 of the bill deals with the state assessment. And currently how the bill reads is it says that at least every 6 months, it is now the executive secretary shall estimate in advance the costs of different portions of the state agency that pay the state assessment fee, and then invoice each of those divisions, and then take the money from them. How it's really worked for about the last 20 years is on a biennial basis. You know, the board, along with DAS, creates the state assessment and sets that fee in advance for the entire 2 years, so it doesn't go up and down, and we don't invoice people each division on a regular basis. The state assessment is really set as part of the legislative process and as part of our overall budget, and that fee just sort of gets set and fixed for 2 years, and then it gets recalculated every 2 years. So this is really just meant to sort of capture that distinction. Section 3 of the bill, it currently reads that a group of unrepresentative employees are the ones who petition the board for a unit clarification petition without an election, and this would change that to a labor organization. This bill was recently passed to allow for unit clarification petitions to be done through what we call as card check, and basically that means that when we get a majority of folks who present representation cards that want us to do something, we go ahead and act on that rather than hold an election. And for the until this bill was passed, really only labor organizations and public employers could file clarification petitions. And this bill only specified that employees, unrepresented employees, could file unit clarification petitions, whereas historically, those bills are really filed by labor organizations and employers, and not by the employees themselves, in terms of the scope of how that unit gets clarified. So this was intended to capture that distinction. Section 4 of the bill, again, this deals with card check petitions. And again, just by way of background, when we get card check petitions, before we act on those, we require that they be signed by a majority of employees, either in the unit that's being petitioned for or in the unit that they're being added to as part of that. We require a 50% majority. At some point when this And there's other parts of the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act that reference that. For some reason, this bill says 30%. It talks about a majority of employees in the first part of it, but then it says that the petition only needs 30%, and we really need cards from a majority of people before we would act on a card check petition. So this was really just intended to sort of capture that. Sections 5, 6, and 7 are really similar. Basically, in 2007, ORS 243.738 was added, although it was not added. That number was not directed by legislative action. It was put there in a note and sort of put there editorially. And basically, we have two groups of public employers, those that can strike and those that can't strike. And 736 and 738 are the folks that cannot strike. And so with that, it means they typically get binding interest arbitration if they can't resolve their disputes. But there's a number of different bills that refer to folks who cannot strike. But currently, the statute just talks about the folks who can't strike under 738. Like I said, in 736 is what it currently does. In 2007, 738 was added, which refers to basically transit employees, transit district employees, who also cannot strike. And this bill is just meant, in all those spots where it references 736, to also add 738. And lastly, the last section of the bill, again, it changes the title of executive secretary to executive manager. I already discussed that in section 1. And it changes the state conciliator from classified service to unclassified. Again, per DAS, that position already is listed as an unclassified position. The statute says that it's a classified position, but it's an executive service unclassified position. And that's, sorry for the long summary, but a lot of little details. I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions on this bill? So I guess I'll throw in a question for you. So largely when I'm looking at what this bill is doing, it looks mostly like it's a clarification of current policy. It's just clarifying the language.
Chair Holby, that's correct.
Okay, thanks. Not really changing the policy.
Terribly, that's correct. It's not intended to do anything different than the really kind of preserve the status quo.
All right. Any other questions for you? Thank you for your preview of those three bills. Appreciate it.
Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Can I ask one question, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Sam Barreto, go ahead.
Yeah, in this Section 3, would you define a little bit better the where you knock out the group of unrepresented employees and change that to labor organization. So it almost sounds like it's the group of unrepresented employees that would maybe like to join into the labor organization, but then you're changing that to the labor organization that files the petition.
Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, that's correct. Once a labor organization is certified as the collective bargaining representative of a group of employees, then anything thereafter is really done by unit clarification, which is what this is. And the reason why historically unit clarification petitions have only been filed and allowed to be filed under our rules before this by employers and labor organizations is that they, at that point on, really get to sort of define the scope of the unit. So if a, for example, a group of employees say, we want to be part of this labor organization.
Right.
The union doesn't really, there's under no obligation to represent them if they don't want to. In the same way that if they initially filed a petition and said, hey, we want you to represent us, the union could say, you know, we're not interested, you're too small, you know, you can go someplace else, that sort of thing. So this is sort of similar to that, in that this sort of the scope of the unit, because the union can also disclaim interest in the unit and say, we don't want to represent this unit anymore, and they're on their own. It's a little bit, you know, sort of a relationship where that's the part of that can kind of end things. So for that reason, they've always been the ones who've been allowed to really clarify the scope of the unit. And the same thing with the public employer. If there's a question about someone, whether they are confidential or supervisory, they can also ask us to clarify the unit. But by and large, it's been the labor organization that really gets to define sort of the scope of the unit once it's certified.
Okay. Thank you.
Not seeing any other questions. If you move quickly.
Can I ask one more question?
Thank you.
Thanks again. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
It appears there's someone else that wants to testify, Bob Livingston. Thank you. If you'd state your name for the record and don't confuse us.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I'm also a career firefighter. My points today will be that for the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And I'll put on the record that we support all three of the bills. I'm going to jump around a little bit. I think, as you can see, I think the chair did a very nice job doing his best to explain kind of what these bills do. I do think it's important for context, though, that there was many people, and they did a great job as far as an agency with transparency and, you know, kind of vetting some of these issues. Traditionally, both employers and employees, either through attorneys or either through people like myself, have been involved in this process to look at, hey, are our statutes up to speed as it relates to labor management relations, and particularly for us in the public workforce, because I guess the quid pro quo for the public workforce in Oregon, for those that are familiar with the National Labor Relations Board in the private sector, here in Oregon for public sector workers like firefighters, police officers, teachers, and nurses that are in the public sector, this is our National Labor Relations Board. And so there was a very good, and I'll applaud the agency. They were very transparent in doing this. There was many people that had input into bringing these three bills forward and to do that. So I think it's important to just let you know that these are not done in isolation. I think the other thing that I'd like to maybe perhaps give a little more context, and I think it perhaps addresses Representative Hack's some of her questions. Historically, since 1973, when the PECBA laws were established and the establishment of ERB went into place, most of this was funded through general fund dollars. Over the years, as you know, because of budgetary issues, for some shape or fashion, fee-based assessments have went into place, whether that's for mediation, whether that's for an unfair labor practice, whether that's for a whole litany of, in essence, services that are provided by this agency. One thing I would suggest, this is a very small agency, but the footprint that they have on the public workforce is significant, and I think a lot of times that gets lost in that. So the history of it, there has been a significant genesis between the most of the dollars were established by general fund dollars, because in essence, this is, instead of going to the circuit courts and litigating things in the circuit courts, by law, this body has elected that, hey, for labor management of our public workforce, this really should be the initial setting of where we adjudicate those cases. And so on that vein, about, I want to say 4 or 6 years ago, there was a pretty deep, holistic view of kind of ERB and the agency. How should we fund things? How should we continue to go forward because of kind of some of those morphemes and that balance between general fund dollars and fees? And so the legislative body, as well as the governor's office, and including labor management representatives, I was one, and there's other people that were in the room that sat on that task force. We really did kind of a deep dive on that, and we talked a lot about these fees. And so part of this is trying to find that balance with fees, and while these may not seem like huge sums of money, and I think the chair mentioned he's trying to make this revenue neutral, as it relates to mediation, as part of the laws, if you're a non-strikeable bargaining unit, like a firefighter unit or a police officer, the public policy in Oregon is probably a good idea not to have those people strike. We concur with that. And so it's a requirement that if you come to impasse, you have to go to mediation. And so there's a fee assessed to that. So both sides have to actually pay for that service to try to say, all right, let's have a third party kind of calm things down. Maybe you're talking past one another to do that. And so my point of that is historically that has served very well. And so there's a balance, though. If you're a small firefighter local or police officer local in some place like, for example, Umatilla or Pendleton, $600-$700 for mediation is not an insignificant amount, not only for the agency, but for the union. These aren't public dollars from the union standpoint. These are members' dollars that they have to contribute to that. And so I think it's important that, again, there's been a lot of vetting of these issues over the years by the legislature and the governor to come to this. And so with that, the last point that I kind of would like to make is that of the bills, the one that I'm the most excited about is the one that addresses, I believe it's 2263. While the chair did a great job, really his main responsibility, the chair right now is the de facto person that has to run the agencies. But unlike, like for example, the school district, that you have a business manager that maybe runs the day-to-day budget and how to do that, by the fact that the Chair Reinhart is the chair, he also has to be the budget officer and all those things. One of the things that both labor and management have agreed upon, it's much more efficient and effective if the board members are actually hearing cases and doing that work and not having to get into the nuances of the day-to-day business practices. And so I think this is a huge step forward to really an agency that's very small. I think it's less than $3 million general fund dollar or $3 million biennial budget. But it's a lot of difficulty to try to wrap your hands around this. This bill will, in essence, make kind of that what used to be deemed as the secretary really more like a business manager that can help answer some of those questions on, hey, why do we have fees and all that, and free up people like the chair to really do what they're there for, and that's to basically a three-panel board that hears issues when there's differences between labor management. On that, just as a refresher, the board is a good practice. It's comprised of a labor representative, a management representative, and then a neutral third party. Traditionally, they're all lawyers. And so I think this is well thought out, three pieces of legislation that are good. I think this continues to kind of meet the needs of what is important work for all of the public workforce. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Livingston? Thank you for providing that clarity for us. I appreciate the input and giving us that background.
Coming out of their paycheck, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Coming out of their
all right.
Paycheck.
Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on any of these three bills? Not seeing any.
Mr. Chair, can I just add that the two bills that deal with fees, they bring in they both have some controls to waste.
Mm-hmm.
I failed to
understand.
Yeah. Start.
It is actually the big one you see there.
All right. Thank you for that. So with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2262, 2263, and 2264. And do we have introduction of committee bills?
We do.
I'd like to open a work session for the possible introduction of committee measures. As well. Mm-hmm. And that, oh, he's got one? Okay.
For
Representative Barreto.
Yes, Chair Holby. I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills, LC 3669, dated January 26, 2017, and LC 3884, dated January 30th, 2017.
Representative Barreto moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills, LC 3669, dated January 26, 2017, and LC 3884, dated January 30th, 2017. Is there any discussion? Somebody want to make, I'll make the note that supporting this does not mean you support the bill or oppose the bill. It merely provides us the ability to introduce this measure for future consideration. So is there any objection to the introduction of these committee LCs as committee measures? Seeing none, they are so adopted. And they're introduced. So anything for else, Jen, on our agenda?
Nothing else.
Nothing else. Surely underestimated our efficiency.
That's okay, we can go.
Rolling down the track. So committee, I appreciate you being here on time. It's, as session moves along, it's going to be a little bit more critical because I mean, this is a time slot that this committee is not used to, where we will be having to vacate slightly before our 2 hours. And so getting started early will be important. And I appreciate everybody's attention to people providing testimony. I think it provides some respect to this process. And look forward to everybody serving on the committee. Any questions for me or for Jan, please let us know if you have questions about what we're doing. I hope to be meeting with my vice chairs on a regular basis so they can inform all of the committee members in their respective caucuses of what we're looking at in the future as best we can. Sometimes it gets a little bit fast-paced as we move along, but we'll do our best to keep everybody informed and try to make this a good, transparent process this session. So with that, I will go ahead and adjourn. Go ahead and adjourn.